Accession number 12068.
Reel 2.
Mr. Beverton, Reel 2.
Yes, Otto May Daniels. She wasn't one of the students, she was one of the lecturers. And she was writing a dictionary of Soshu, which is the Japanese fast writing character technique. And she was the wife of Professor Frank Daniels, who was also one of our lecturers on the course.
Can you remember the names of any of the other students who were in your group?
Well, the group of nine. We had a class leader whom we sort of looked up to, a chap called Louis Allen, who I think is now on television programmes, around Britain Quiz, isn't he?
Yes.
And I don't know why we all nominated him to be our class leader, probably because he was the eldest, also because of his strength of character. We had a cartoonist amongst the group who always portrayed him as a Churchill tank chin cartoonist. And he was very forthright and outspoken, so he was our class leader. And I happened to share a table with him, which meant that we got along quite well together, although, as I say, he was a man of many characteristics and facets. Next to him, we had a young fellow called Roger Fry. His name wasn't Roger, his name was Peter, P.J.M. Fry. He was small in stature, extremely witty, and got along very well with Louis Allen in their repartee wit. He had a wry sense of humour, very intelligent, very meticulous, lived over with his parents in Putney. And I think the only one who lived with his parents at the time. Although there was Ken Gardner, who was a very dour, gentle, kindly person, who lived, I think it was Bean Cottage in Hertfordshire. He was a reserved individual, always spoke with moderation, and weighed up his words before he said anything. The antithesis of Ken Gardner was Ronald Johnson, commonly called Johnny, who was very ebullient, outward-going, outspoken, pleasure-seeking, lively individual, who found academic work without the excitement of society dead hard going. And he would much rather go to dances and social evenings rather than stay at home and read a book. I think he was doing Latin and Greek, tripos. He was one of my close associates when we left the course. Also one of my close associates then was Stan Radcliffe, who was a Liverpudlian, although he came from the Cheshire side of the river, was an ornithologist of no mean stature, very quiet, academic to a certain extent, but also very kindly and gentle sort of person. In fact, it was Stanley Radcliffe who introduced me to Beethoven's fourth piano concerto. He's a great lover of music, and when he explained the background to the dilemma that Beethoven was in his conception of the piece, I seem to understand the music better, and I still regard that as one of the best concertos I've heard. He also introduced me to rudimentary, elementary ornithology. Beforehand, I knew nothing about flying birds. In addition to that, there was Jim Follen, who was a Dour Scotsman, who lived at Dundee, was in education after he'd finished the course, a keen photographer, also with a wry sense of humour, very tall, I think academic, but he didn't give much away. He sort of kept his cards close to his chest. John Hartley was the cartoonist in our group. He was brilliant. He managed to sort of evince a picture of each individual in the group in a matter of seconds, which he filled the blackboard with when we should have been doing Chinese characters, Japanese characters. And he filled sheets of paper with. He pictured every one of us in the group with amazing accuracy. I think he was academic in many respects. He came from Sheffield originally. How many have I got through it now?
About six.
More than six, I think. Well, of the others, there was John Sargent, who unfortunately I knew very little about. He was the quietest, the most stolid, and the most dour of all our party. And he unfortunately died of leukemia in the 1960s. There was one other guy who was the opposite to John Sargent, whose name I can't even remember now. Oh, Shaw, that was his name, who was always shooting lines about his past experience. And unfortunately, he didn't stay the course.
What level of proficiency had you achieved in Japanese by the time you'd finished the course?
That's hard to say. At the time, we had a working conversation, only working. Our vocabulary was limited because we had lacked experience and practice of it. And we acquitted ourselves reasonably well in the examinations. We've since had a viewing of an assessment of us all, unnamed, whereby we managed to sort of assess our achievement at the time in the course. And Louis Allen, I think, is streets ahead of everybody else because of his linguistic prowess in speaking French, Spanish, Portuguese, all the Latin style languages. And he went to Japanese like a duck to water. But unfortunately, I didn't pursue Japanese after I finished the course and left the army. And all I remember just odd words until we meet at our annual reunion since the war and exchange a few Japanese pleasantries in cliched phrases. But I can't really tell the actual standard we reached because I don't know how they would measure it. But we were issued with a magnifying glass, which I still have actually, upstairs to us, to enable us to go and read the minute detail of the Chinese characters, which you had to look up in dictionaries, which was quite an art in itself. And to us, the magnifying glass was an essential part of our equipment, even more important than the revolvers we wished with later on.
What happened to you after the course?
Well, the majority of us, there were nine in the course, six went on to become translators and interpreters. And they went with the, they left the course at the end of October 1944 and went to the Intelligence Corps depot where they spent the winter, and eventually they went over to India, Delhi, and went to frontline posts afterwards. But strangely enough, three of us, and I still to this day don't know why, were selected by an interview at Lancaster Gate in September 1944 by Major Davis to become members of MI6, working at the Foreign Office, or working through the Foreign Office. The three of us chosen were Stan Radcliffe, Ronald Johnson, and myself. And I can't understand why we three were selected, because psychologically, personally, we were different from each other. Academically, I suppose, we also varied. Perhaps we were the same, I don't know. But there was certainly a social difference between us, apart from that, we're all middle class, I suppose, because Johnny and I sort of hated each other's guts at the time. He was a true blue royalist Englishman, and I was a Republican, if you call it such, with affiliations with pre-war Nazi Germany. And he said I should be shot as a traitor. But, I mean, since then, since we've met up over the years, we have integrated far more than I have with Stan Radcliffe, with whom I felt I had a greater rapport at the time. But at any rate, we finished the course, and the three of us, Stan Radcliffe, Johnny, myself, went into the Government Communications Bureau. Incidentally, I don't know if you've seen this. I brought this down.
This is a certificate of employment.
Yes.
Essential services in war, it says.
Yes, Government Communications Bureau, they called us, which was the interpretation for MI6.
That was just a cover name for it.
Well, I suppose so. It's sort of, it was an umbrella organisation, really. But anyway, we were taken off the army payroll. We went to 54 Broadway, which was the headquarters of the Government Communications Bureau. And we were allocated an office in 14 Ryder Street, which became our temporary headquarters for the next 11 months or so, where we worked with a Major Stopford Adams and one or two other people whose names I've forgotten at the moment. And we learnt, to some extent, the trade we were going to enter. We had to go on a motor bike driving course for 4 days at Kensington Barracks, followed by a 4-day car driving course or 1,500-weight truck driving course at Kensington Barracks. And we used to take the car and the motorbike around the west end of London with the three of us in tow, with a corporal looking after us, having picked up our gear from Savile Row. And Obviously, there were many amusing incidents of that, but that was my first driving test. We were issued at the end of 4 days motorcycle driving and 4 days car driving with a certificate of proven ability, which lasts 1 year. And from that course, we went on to a microphotography course in Sloane Square on the fifth floor of a block of flats. And there we learned to photograph documents and so on, and how to look after our own films and deal with them. We also, around that part of London, between there and Grosvenor Square, that area, we had to go on sleuthing courses, or surveillance, which we didn't use in those days. They just called them sleuthing. We had to go and trail somebody without being noticed. And we also went to Bletchley for a course of 3 days on codes and ciphers, how to set up a code, how to decipher it, the various codes that were in existence. And of course the life up there was a bit esoteric in a way for those who were inside the Bletchley Park house. But being a lance corporal, or perhaps I was a full corporal by then, I think that we were still looked upon as common or garden soldiers and given sort of barrack-room huts to go and live in. And only when we crossed the line, as it were, did we become members of a civilised society with the rest of the officers amongst the wrens of Bletchley House, where they had hotel accommodation of quite a high degree. And we also learned about some of the machinations of MI6, how to hide things, how to conceal documents. I forgot the actual place we went to, but one of the things that stuck in my mind was the fact that if I was to go and divulge anything about the work we were doing, I'd be liable for 14 years imprisonment plus a £500 fine, which rather took the gloss off the gingerbread. And this went on for some weeks and months. But as part of our training, we were sent over to Northwest Europe, which seemed to be an anomaly at the time, because here we were, having spent 18 months learning Japanese at government expense, and the cost of the state of God knows how many pounds. And then we were being sent over to the Far East, over to Northwest Europe, where the nearest Japanese was about 10,000 miles away. And we became members of SHAFE, which is this thing here.
This is your SHAFE pass. Mm. It says Allied Expeditionary Force Permit, Northwest Europe.
And we were attached to the 103 Special Intelligence Unit. And we had palatial accommodation, which was in the Avenue de Tavurne, in the suburbs of Brussels, near the big triumphal arch of the Cinquantenaire, where the German Luftwaffe had once had their headquarters, I understand. And I was very lucky, very pleasing, in fact, to get a room with a balcony overlooking the avenue. And I didn't go with Stanley or Johnny at the time. I went after the others, which means I had to go and make my own way across the channel by any craft that I could get my feet on board, from motor MTB to ferry or whatever it was. And I went down there. First day there was winter in January 1945 was very, very cold, and the sea was frozen apparently and very dangerous for crossing. So the first day I went down there was no travelling across. Second day I went down, there was no travelling across. And I got rather fed up with this business eventually, so I, instead of going back home again each time, I stayed the night at the transit camp on the road to Margate, which was, again, a tip with straw on the floor and smelling blankets and so forth. And eventually got away on the third day. But not to Ostend, which I should have done. I got on a ship going to Calais. And then we went to the German transit camp there, which had been even more pitifully shot up during the war, and managed to get a Red Cross train going to Brussels, which got to Brussels at about 4 o'clock in the morning, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And when I saw the RTO officer there, I was told that I had to wait until the morning, go to sleep in the waiting room, curl up on a bench somewhere. But I was very fortunate, as I had several cups of tea with the YMCA man. He took me to his flat, so I got a camp bed for the night. Although it was cold, at least it was somewhere to sleep properly. And eventually, the following morning, I went up to my headquarters at Avenue de Vuren. After a fortnight, I went up to spend 2 weeks with the 1st Canadian Division in Holland at the what they called the field headquarters. And we stayed in a small suburban house on the edge of Tilburg with lace curtains at the window, very comfortably furnished inside, with a captain in command, Captain Pidcock, a Lieutenant Dixhorn, who was number two, who drove a Hudson car and picked us up, and a wireless operator, and two Dutch underground workers who had been in the underground during the war, a chap called Nico and another one called André, one of whom had been a chef in Potsdam, and who, when he got back to Holland, found his wife was sleeping with the German and sort of joined the resistance as a result. And the other one, who was telling us harrowing stories about how the German Gestapo, through the help of the Dutch police, who were even more Gestapo-like in their activities, used to round people up from cinemas. Round people up who were in cinemas and then get them transported over to work schemes in Germany. But it was mainly an area where we dealt with information that came through on various areas, and then we referred it, collated it, collected it, and disseminated it to various sources that we had at our disposal. And it was routine work, I suppose, I was doing, but I was just learning the trade. And I was in the hands of the people we were with. But it was an opportunity to go and see how the Dutch had fared as a result of the occupation. And from what I could see locally, they weren't starving as one had thought. But they were short of fuel. It was a very cold winter, and a lot of people were chopping down trees in woods and coppices and firing their own fires. And they still had this time when the flying bombs were coming over, although I think they'd stopped flying over in London at the time because the bases in France and Belgium had been captured, and the front line was now on the Maas and the Rhine, and the Germans on the north side of the river, and we were on the south side of the river with the Canadians. And so we used to see these flying bombs come over every few minutes, and mostly on the way to Brussels or places south. Occasionally, we had one or two landing in the area, which was rather sad, because our radio sergeant, who was an odd guy in many respects, a great hulk of a man, who every time he used to hear a flying bomb come over, he used to roll his eyes and waggle a finger and stop what he was doing, even in the middle of a meal. He used to sort of drop knives and forks and rush outside. He had to be outside, out of doors. And on one occasion, I remember the first time one landed in the road, a flying bomb came over, we heard it, he rolled it in his eyes, and it disappeared overhead. And then we heard what he said was another one coming along. And I said, it's probably the echo of the other one, the first one that's gone, to try and lay his fears. And before you could say knife, before you could even get up from the table, there was a shattering explosion which sent all the glass showering across the room. And I heard a child cry next door, and we rushed outside, and we saw a great pall of smoke at the end of the road, which masked the damage that this bomb had fallen. And the peace of these local burghers, local citizens in the area, as I say, it was a quite a pleasant suburb of Tilburg, were absolutely distraught. There was a dog howling with blood coming from its coat, there was a child crying, and eventually we learned that 9 people had been killed. And the irony of the situation was that we were still concerned about our breakfast, which hadn't been served. And that, I know it sounds horrible in wartime, but of course, before you could say knife, the hospital services or the Red Cross services had arrived on the scene and were transporting the wounded and the dead away from the bombed houses. But we were all invited to the funeral of these people afterwards, and they regarded us as friends of the locality. So anyway, we were over there for 2 weeks before we were sent back to Brussels again. And apart from our routine work in Brussels, it was very nice being at the Scheif's headquarters in such idyllic surroundings. And we managed to get a chance to see the opera and the concerts in Brussels at the time. Although we had a curfew at midnight in the city, I shall long cherish the memory of travelling on Brussels trams from the Place Blücher in the centre of Brussels to back to the Avenue de Tréviotin on the outskirts. And if you couldn't get a seat on the inside of the tram, you travelled on the outside of the tram, hanging onto the windows or doors, or where Stan Radcliffe and myself once did, travelling on the couplings between the two trams, which is an awe-inspiring game, if you like to think about it, as a game when trams go around the bend, you get the arm coming over in a sheer right-angle arc, and if you don't look lively to get your feet off one bar onto the next one that's coming across, you like to end up with your feet dangling over the tram lines. And the tram bells ringing at every time anybody got in front of a tram, a car was in the way or somebody crossed the tram lines. The bells seemed to ring all the time. But it was exciting and it was very pleasant being in Brussels. But we felt that as we trained to learn Japanese and we wanted to get into some sort of action doing the work we trained for, we sent signals back to London, asked them when we were going to be moved back to London, and the telepenters got to work and sent a message eventually calling us back to London to resume our work with the Coordination Bureau.
Communications Bureau?
Oh yes, that the Coordination Bureau is the one I went to in the Far East. So we arrived back in London. And we were more concerned about our promotion because we were still corporals or sergeants at that time of the day. And the routine work carried on. I did translating of various documents that came from various places in Europe, usually from Portugal or Spain or by the neutral countries. And it meant that I had to get... If we didn't get the translations done in Ryder Street, they had to be sent over to some American source to be done by them, who had more interpreters or translators at hand than I think we did. But as I was on the site with my two colleagues, we sort of got some of the translation work done in Ryder Street and the documentation, dissemination of work that we'd achieved.
Why had you done all those courses in sleuthing and...